Well, the topic that was assigned to me was Judah, a character study, as in one of the 12 brothers. And I didn't like it. I wasn't going to do it. And then I decided, well, you know, somebody has to sometime. And so I'm going to do that. I'm going to look at the texts that have Judah in it in Genesis. There's a lot of biblical writers comment on those texts, but that's what I'm going to focus on. And I'll read some and talk about some of the things that are connected with that. And then I'll look to you, you faithful little audience here, to help me by asking questions or by disagreeing or just clarifying on things that I bring up. So I think I'll start with the first mention of Judah, and that's in Genesis 29:35. And I do want to read one verse about Judah's mother to sort of set things off, and you don't have to turn to that, but it's in 29:16. In the King James, and I'm going to be reading out of the New Jerusalem Bible, and in the King James, Leah, that would be Judah's mother, is described in 29:16 as being tender-eyed. I didn't know what that meant, but this is a little different here. It says, now Laban had two daughters, the elder named Leah, and the younger Rachel. Leah had lovely eyes, but Rachel was shapely and beautiful. So that's Jake or Judah's mother. So 29:35. This would be the fourth son of Jacob and the fourth son of Leah. And it says here, again, she conceived and gave birth to a son and said, now I shall praise Yahweh. Accordingly, she named him Judah. And then she had no more children. Now, the next time Judah shows up, there's a list in 35, and he's just listed with all the brothers and their sons and maybe their wives. But in 37:26, we are in the Joseph story there. And we all know that Joseph was kind of a brat, and he tattled on his older brothers. And he also had a big head. He had dreams, and it was kind of awkward and a little annoying, even to his mother and father. So his brothers didn't care for him very much, and they were so upset with him they wanted to kill him. So let's go here to 37. And there are people who believe that there are several traditional ways of telling this story that were in the oral tradition and that they've been combined in this, and that there's a story in which Reuben plays the sort of deliverer role, and there's one in which Judah does, and there's just a scrap here, but I will read that. Then Judah said to his brothers about Joseph, what do we gain by killing our brother and covering up his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites. Then we shall not have laid hands on him ourselves. After all, he is our brother and our own flesh. So we have Reuben making a fairly eloquent plea for his little brother, his bratty little brother's life. Now there's the chapter 38. And this is, you know, what I think of when I think of Judah, because it's a vivid story. It's kind of lurid. And it's here to deal with. And I think what I'll do is I'll simply read it, and then I'll make some comments. And I'd like you to follow along and think about the story and try to think about what the point is of chapter 38. Because I'm not completely sure that I understand it. I have some ideas, but we'll get there. So starting with verse 1, the story of Judah and Tamar. It happened at about that time that Judah left his brothers to go down and settle with a certain Adullamite named Hira. There Judah saw the daughter of a Canaanite named Shua. He made her his wife, slept with her. She conceived and gave birth to a son whom she named Ur. She conceived again and gave birth to a son whom she named Onan. Yet again she gave birth to a son whom she named Shelah. She was at Chezib when she gave birth to him. Judah took a wife for his firstborn Ur, and her name was Tamar. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, offended Yahweh, and Yahweh killed him. Then Judah said to Onan, "Take your brother's wife and do your duty as her brother-in-law to maintain your brother's line." Now I'm just going to pause here and just have a few words about levirate marriage, just so we understand what the rules were then, because we don't do that anymore in this country. Now, there are countries where that's still practiced, and the one country I know of is Kenya, among the Luo people. But what Judah is asking Onan to do is marry his brother's wife, and the idea of levirate marriage is Ur died, he had no children, so any inheritance, his share of inheritance that he was getting from Judah would simply be lost. It would be divided up to the other two brothers, to Onan and Shelah. Well, that's sad, and especially for his wife, because she can't inherit anything. Tamar was basically disinherited. So the law, the levirate law of marriage was, that's not good, and Ur deserves to have a son, and so Onan is going to help out here, and the first son that he has with Tamar will inherit the stuff that Ur would get from Judah and that he would have accumulated already. So that's the backdrop there. But Onan, knowing that the line would not count as his, spilt his seed on the ground every time he slept with his brother's wife to avoid providing offspring for his brother. What he did was offensive to Yahweh, who killed him too. Then Judah said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, "Go home as a widow to your father until my son Shelah grows up." For he was thinking, he must not die like his brothers. So Tamar went home to her father. Judah wanted to have somebody still alive that was his child. You can't really blame him. Long time passed, and then Shua's daughter, the wife of Judah, died. After Judah had been comforted, he went up to Timnah for the shearing of his sheep. He and his friend, Hira the Adullamite. When Tamar was told, "Look, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah for the shearing of his sheep," she changed out of her widow's clothes, wrapped a veil around her to disguise herself, and sat down at the entrance of Enam, which is on the way to Timnah, for she saw that although Shelah was grown up, she had not been given to him as his wife. Judah, seeing her, took her for a prostitute, since her face was veiled. Going up to her on the road, he said, "Here, let me sleep with you." He did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. "What will you give me for sleeping with you?" she asked. "I will send you a kid from the flock," he said. "Agreed, if you give me a pledge until you send it," she replied. "What pledge shall I give you?" he asked. "Your seal and cord and the staff you are holding," she replied. And that seal and cord would have been a little circular thing with a design in it. And if Judah would have signed a document, it might have been in wet clay, and he would have rolled that little seal in that clay. And when it dried, then it would be obvious to people that, yep, that was Judah who gave his word for it. So that was an important thing for him to give. He gave them to her and slept with her, and she conceived by him. Then she got up and left him, and taking off her veil, resumed her widow's weeds. Judah sent the kid by his friend the Adullamite to recover the pledge from the woman, but he did not find her. He inquired from the men of the place, "Where is the prostitute who was by the roadside at Enion?" "There has been no prostitute here," they answered. So returning to Judah, he said, "I did not find her. What is more, the men of the place told me there has been no prostitute there. Let her keep the things," Judah said, "or we shall become a laughingstock. At least I sent her this kid, even though you did not find her." About 3 months later, Judah was told, "Your daughter-in-law has played the harlot. Furthermore, she is pregnant as a result of her misconduct. Bring her out," Judah ordered, "and let her be burnt alive." But as she was being led off, she sent word to her father-in-law, "It was the owner of these who made me pregnant. Please verify," she said, "whose seal and cord and staff these are." Judah recognized them and said, "She was right and I was wrong, since I did not give her to my son, Shelah." He had no further intercourse with her. When the time for her confinement came, there were twins in her womb. During the delivery, one of them put out a hand, and the midwife caught it and tied a scarlet thread to it, indicating that this was the first to arrive. Whereupon he drew back his hand, and out came his brother. Then she said, "What a breach you have opened for yourself." So he was named Perez. Then his brother came out with the scarlet thread on his hand, so he was named Zerah. Well, we've talked about levirate marriage. I want to point out that there are different schools of thought about how exactly the words that we have in the books of Moses have come to us. And there is, in the last 300 years, there have been people, scholars, and people who are serious about the Bible who've taken to explaining that there are sort of four general traditions that combine traditions of oral telling of stories and then maybe also of writing that have been combined in what we have here. And this chapter and most of what we have about Judah is attributed to the Yahwist, partly because the author, we don't know who this was, and it's sort of theoretical, uses Yahweh as in reference to God rather than Elohim or some of the El combinations. And the Yahwist is characterized as being very interested in the stories of human beings and their relationship to the earth, to soil. The story of Cain being cursed by the ground would be attributed to the Yahwist. And a lot of the stories that we remember as vivid narratives like this one are attributed to the Yahwist, and just the J is used to describe that. And The other three are the Eloist, and this is theoretical. I want you to understand it. Just it's helpful to know what people think sometimes and how they study. I bought this Bible when I was in school, and I bought it for a class called The Bible as Literature. And at that time and in that place, you started by talking about this sort of thing, and then, you know, other stuff came up as well. But the Eloist would have been more focused on the covenant and on prophetic leadership, where the Yahwist is more about action and war and stories like this one. Then there's the Deuteronomist, who focuses more on judgment, maybe, and on obedience to the Deuteronomic law. Less grace there, maybe. And then the priestly writer, also theoretical, obviously focuses on priesthood and on the priestly traditions and on ritual, and is obsessed with dates and numbers. Maybe obsessed isn't the right word, but interested in that. You know, when I think of the priestly person, I think, you know, if Perry Lee would write, a book, he would focus on the numbers and stuff, you know. Just to give you an idea, there's a personality that presents itself through writing, and we might not think about it, but if you think about it, you get a letter from somebody that you know already, you've heard them talk, and you can tell it's them by the words they use and by what they're interested in and what they focus on. And that's textual analysis, is just looking at the character, the characterization of the words that are used in the arrangement. So that's enough of that for now. You're welcome to address it or talk about it. I don't know that much about it, but enough to explain it that well. I got sidetracked here. I wanted to say something else about Judah. Oh, the point of the story. You know, there's a couple of things they could be. These are things I thought about that didn't really make it. Canaanite wives make trouble. Judah was a sex monster. Tamar was evil. Women were just property then. And this is what I finally think is close. This is my best shot, and I'm looking to you for help on this. Judah was a decent man, and he didn't want to make trouble, but he really did want grandchildren. And when he was caught in an embarrassing situation, even though Tamar was really kind of like his property, and he probably could have just gone ahead and burnt her, and it would have been less embarrassing for himself, he didn't. He said, and I'm going to read that again, "She was right, and I was wrong, since I did not give her to my son, Shelah." And I think that says a little more about Judah than we might notice because of all the sort of exciting other details that show up in the story. But I think that is the clue to understanding Judah. And maybe we can combine that with a few other things that we'll look at about Judah. You're welcome to just pipe up with comments whenever you think of them.
I have a question.
Yeah.
It's not clear to me. I think maybe you covered it, but then Reuben and Judah's role, and when they disposed of Joseph, who did what?
Well, it looks like there are a couple of stories because Ishmaelites took him and then Midianites took him. And Judah's saying, let's save him alive, and it kind of works, but then there's this other thing in which Reuben was thinking, let's put him in this pit, and later I'll sneak over here and rescue him. You know what I mean? And I would say that the King James Version works a little harder at connecting what may be sort of little jerky places in the story, which some people would say, well, that's indicating that it's very... And I'm saying this respectfully and reverently, just the careful, maybe not even editing, the word is redacting, connecting of the fragments of stories to make it as clear as possible. Is that what you were asking?
Yes, that's what I was asking. I think we could conclude then that both Judah and Reuben did have noble motives than the other brothers.
Right. Now, what's different is Reuben didn't get much credit for anything noble. You know, we'll end up at the blessing of Jacob, and he gets pretty nasty blessing, actually. It's almost a curse. And Judah is just lauded to high heaven. But we'll wait for that. Because it is Judah we're focusing on tonight. I mean, that's what I was assigned. Now we want to remember that Judah is a minor character, an important minor character in the Joseph story. Joseph is the center of the end of Genesis. And the refrain, I want to bring this up before I forget, the refrain of the Joseph story is, you brothers had evil intent, and you meant to do me harm, but God has turned all of your bad actions into a great blessing for our family. That's brought up several times in several different ways, and we want to come back and address that before we're done here. But let's, unless there are other comments so far... Yeah, Gary.
Well, I'd just like to recognize that there's a lot of to be admired for Judah to say she's more righteous than I. But even in that, the morality that the Bible brings teaches us was marred, was not lived by.
Oh, you want to make sure that we're not saying it was okay. We shouldn't go do this now if we think it would.
Well, I'm wondering if we want to say that in a way. That's part of that question.
Well, it's a good point to bring up because I'm trying to understand it in the context of the story. And it obviously was an embarrassment to Judah's household to have one of his daughters-in-law being accused of being a harlot, and she was going to be burnt alive, which is a pretty harsh punishment.
Well, understand my comment isn't so much addressed to you as it is to the scriptures and to Judah's testimony.
So you're finding fault with this? That's why I read it, because I knew, you know, if I just tried to say it, then I might get some heat. Yeah, well, that I appreciate that, and that helps me remind me of maybe not. You know, I think that should be addressed, and I would say the story isn't about prostitution. Maybe it's more about Judah responding redemptively and honorably when when it could have been easy for him to just hide that and destroy the evidence. And I don't think this story is really something that's trying to teach us about. Well, I don't know. I'm just not going to.
I agree. I think that's sort of the way it is in any story.
Right, and that's in keeping with the tradition of the Yahwist or the J. Rider, too. It's a better story than it is a precept, maybe. Yes, Benji. I think his primary shame was that his daughter-in-law played the harlot. I mean, that had the most severe repercussion in this story. He apparently wasn't considered, he was just being a guy, I guess. And I think that underscores the different role of women and men in society at that time. And so Judah mattered a lot more than Tamar did. Tamar was the owned person, really, and Judah was the owner. And I guess it's worth just pointing out that I see the story of God's people as a progressive and something that in which God continues to reveal himself more perfectly, that would be one way to say it, through time. And so I believe that we today understand more fully the will of God than Judah did at that time. And that we understand it not just because we're smarter, but because generations of sincere people have done their best to learn from the stories of their ancestors and God has revealed to them and reveals to us through those stories. Yes, Paul. Maybe not, but it's obvious from the story that there were some very clear ideas about right and wrong here, and you know, bigger and littler sins. You know, this one gets burned by fire, that one, you know, you just sort of shrug. So I agree with you, at least in the theory of, you know, this comes before that, but we learn from this, within the story, that there were expectations and right and wrong going on there. I mean, you know, Jacob married sisters, and in Leviticus, that's one of the rules. You may not marry, the second wife may not be a sister to the first wife or something like that. So they were maybe just working that out still. Okay, let's shift, unless there's some other urgent thing, to the next important moment with Judah, and that is in 43, verse 3. This is after the brothers have been to Egypt the first time, and they've almost run out of food, and Jacob says, "Oh, please, just go get us a little food back in Egypt." But Judah replied, "The man expressly warned us, 'You will not be admitted to my presence unless your brother is with you.'" Speaking of Benjamin, "If you are ready to send our brother with us, we will go down and get food for you. But if you are not ready to send him, we will not go down in view of the man's warning." And there's more of that. But Judah is sort of the responsible person. He speaks like the oldest brother here. It's not Reuben that's saying this and reasoning with Jacob and speaking for the brothers, but Judah is. And now let's go to 44. I'm not touching every little thing, just sort of the highlights. Let's go to 44, verse 16. And this is after the brothers have been there and everybody's been sent back, and it looks like a successful foray to Egypt. Everybody has food in their sacks, on their donkeys, And then the steward rushes after and berates them and says, why have you taken my Lord's silver cup that I used to foretell the future, tell whether it's going to be 7 good years or bad or something? And they said, and Judah was like, we wouldn't do that, and if somebody has that, he'll have to die. And wouldn't, of course, it's in Benjamin's sack. They tore their clothes in 13, and then in 16, what can we answer, my Lord? Judah replied, what can we say? How can we clear ourselves? God himself has uncovered your servant's guilt. Here we are then, my Lord's slaves, we no less than the one in whose possession the cup was found. I could not think of doing such a thing, he replied. The man in whose possession the cup was found shall be my slave. You can go back unhindered to your father. So this is the setup then. For Judah's intervention for Benjamin. And I'm going to say this is kind of in character for Judah. He's a person who cares about grandchildren and even a brother that was kind of an obnoxious brother. But he gives an impassioned plea to the steward and to Joseph, describing in every way how horrible this would be, for Benjamin not to come back with them to Jacob. And it sort of repeats a lot of what was said. Will I read? And it ends up saying, if I go to your servant, my father, now, and we do not have the boy with us, he will die as soon as he sees that the boy is not with us, for his heart is bound up with him. And your servants will have sent your servant, our father's white head, down to Sheol with grief. And of course, at the end of that impassioned plea, Joseph first goes out because he can't contain himself, and he cries, comes back and explains that he is indeed the brother that they had sold. The one thing I want to address here, and I'm going to sort of give it out to you, is what Judah meant when he said up here, God himself has uncovered your servant's guilt. Certainly he's not saying that they were guilty of stealing the money or the silver cup that was in their sacks. How do we understand what he's saying there? He could have been, yeah. And I think that's a pretty likely thing that he would have been thinking about. And maybe also there's a sense in which if you have trouble, if things go wrong, and I have days, today was kind of like that, stuff just didn't go together right, and the seal leaked, and it was a lot of work getting the water pump back off again. And there's a sense sometimes with us now, and maybe more so in this less organized maybe time, in which if you have trouble, God is sort of giving you that sort of evil eye almost. And back in the story with Ur, there's not even a reason. Ur just irritated Yahweh, and Yahweh killed him. And so I'm not quite sure what to make of this, but it feels like Jude is just having a really bad day.
Can you explain the first
Well, he's so convinced that they didn't do it. And he's pointing out, look, you know, there was money in our sacks before. We brought it back double. We're honest people. We're not trying to steal your stuff. We just need food so we and our families can stay alive. You know, that's the basis. You know, it would be bad to take the cup knowing that you'd have to probably come back and get more food, even if you didn't know it was a special cup. I mean, what good is a silver cup if you don't have any food? You know, what good is money if you don't have any food? I mean, that's all I was basing that on. Say that again, I couldn't quite hear.
Your eyes were clearly guilty. And nothing I can say will prove my innocence, he says.
Yeah, the evidence is in the sack.
Yeah. So I guess I would have thought it was referring not to his own perception of their guilt, due to his own perception of their guilt, but the apparent guilt that Joseph is.
Yeah, well, that's not an unreasonable way of thinking about it. And I'm not sure either. And I think that's usually the first explanation for this passage. And I don't think it's wrong. What I want to point out is there is a sense that we have, and that probably was more keenly felt in that time and in that place, that if bad things happen to you, you deserve them, even if you don't know why. And that comes to a question that I want to bring up a little bit about, and I sort of brought it up already about the Joseph story, this idea that, you know, the human beings in the Joseph story, the brothers had, they really responded over the top. You know, all little brothers, I mean, many little brothers are brats and tattle, and we know that. But it's not really appropriate to sell them to the Midianites. So what Joseph is coming back, and you understand it, he's trying to put his brothers at ease. He's saying, you meant it for evil. You know, that was a really bad thing you did. You meant it for evil, but God has turned it around for good. And to me, that speaks... Or on the face of it, it looks like fatalism, in which I guess it wouldn't really matter. We just do whatever we do, and God is going to make things work out in his own way, the way he wants them to. I mean, that's one way of looking at that, and I'm just sort of throwing that out, and I'd like responses from you. Let's look at the text a little, because I don't want to be saying the wrong thing here. Yeah. What verse is that in? In which chapter? Is see, we want to stick with the text here, just so that we don't get... I want where Jacob responds to the dreams. Okay. This is off subject. You all know that. This is not about Judah. Thank you. He told his father and brothers, and his father scolded him. A fine dream to have, he said to him. Are all of us then, myself, your mother, and your brothers, to come and bow down to the ground before you? That's what his father said. That was a scolding. I think a pretty a heartfelt scolding. And Jacob scolded him for telling it. He probably should have just had the dream and shut his mouth. His father pondered the matter. So he found fault with it, but he was a thoughtful man and wasn't going to just dismiss it. Yes, Gary. Forgot what other point I was making. Oh, yeah, he was a tattler, wasn't he? He brought his father bad reports about them. Doesn't say what. Well, it's usually, I connect it with maybe a person who's, you know, a youth or a child and doesn't quite understand a situation and makes it worse by reporting maybe almost inappropriate things. Now, sometimes it's helpful and good. And I don't want to belabor this, but if we want to talk about it a minute, that's okay. Yeah, it doesn't say the behavior problems here. Later, no, when they put him in the pit, that was probably pretty bad behavior. You know, that's a good point. And, that's another lurid tale. And Judah was not involved in that, at least in the story. And Levi and Simeon, and maybe Dan, they didn't hear the last of that until their father's deathbed. And he scolded them then. And that was a much more serious scolding than Joseph got for having a dream and telling it. So that's a good point. These guys were rash, and they were ready to fight, and they were ready to fight dirty, actually, is how I would describe that story. Okay. Let me just see if I've missed any important things yet here. Well, there's speculation, and you know that's kind of how it is. And there's two things I'll point out. Writing, you know, we know at some stage was a newfangled, just development. It was modern and treated with great suspicion. There's a king that's recorded further on in the book here, in the Bible. And a prophet who was afraid to speak to him orally wrote his prophecy down, sent it to the king, and the king couldn't read. And he didn't really care for reading and writing. And it says that he had someone read it to him, and as they read a section, he took his penknife out and cut it off and threw it in the fire. So that's one response. And then oral traditions, I think maybe what I hear you say, and I've thought this too, how could they last that long and how could they stay true? And I'll give you an example of one oral tradition I heard a few years back. Leroy Beachy told me this. He said he visited a Swartzentruber Amish church service in Ohio, and he heard the minister explain why Amish churches have communion not once but twice a year. And he said, the minister did, he said, Jacob Ammon organized that, and he did it so that women who were pregnant one year after the other, kind of, and back in the day, they would stay at home. You know, it said something about a confinement here, and that's like, you know, you don't go out in public if you're obviously pregnant. And it could be, if when they had communion only at Easter, that maybe a woman who had five or six children, she might miss communion for 5 or 6 years. And so having it twice a year made it much likelier that everybody could have communion twice a year. And Leroy Beachy assures me that's not written down anywhere. That's been passed down for over 300 years orally. And I have no reason not to believe it. It's not the kind of story. It's a believable story. Just in defense of oral tradition, I don't think it diminishes anything to say that this was a story that was carefully spoken and remembered for many years. Can everyone hear when David L. speaks? Shall I repeat that or try to? Are you listening? Do you hear me? I'm just checking. I'll be glad to try and reiterate it if I need to. David's just saying that David Berceau, right? He's an author, a contemporary author, says that theologians are not always friendly towards I'm just going to put words in your mouth, a conservative approach to understanding the scriptures. And that we should not underestimate the value of simply comparing scriptures and having conversations about them with other serious scholars of the Bible. We'll just say observers and followers of the Bible. And that specialists and scholars sometimes can lead us astray. And I think that's good advice, and that we should be careful that we don't sort of reason ourselves off into la-la land. And maybe the response to that, and I say it as in a friendly way, is that we also don't want to be simplistic and fail to see the forest for the trees almost. So I think that's very good advice, and we want to consider that carefully.
I think you made a good point. Not simplistic, but simple.
Yeah, that is right. I think the most important truths can be simply explained, but we don't want to oversimplify complicated things. That's a problem that has been recognized since Aristotle. You don't try to explain a complex thing in terms that are too simple. That's as big an error as going the other way. And Gary, were you going to say something?
Yeah, I would also be one that would assume that there could have been God's blessing on passing down oral traditions as part of the early history. I would also subscribe to this
Sure, yeah, and I don't quibble with that. I believe that God still reveals himself in numerous different ways to us today. Yes, Lowell. Well, that's certainly been, that's certainly a way of understanding that. And I'll point out that the Frenchmen and some of the Germans in the 17th century who suggested that Moses may not have written everything with his own hand, with a whatever it was, they were persecuted. I think some of them actually were killed because of suggesting that. They were considered heretics. So I guess I'm taking my life in my hands and bringing this up. Thank you so much. And I'm not subscribing to it. It's just it's something that a person should be aware of, and it in some ways it may be helpful in understanding the way texts are arranged. Was there another hand that I overlooked? No, okay. I want to go to Jacob's deathbed. And that's the 49th chapter of Genesis. Reuben, as we can see right up there, he just doesn't get a whole lot of blessing. And Simeon and Levi, they have to remember that they carried out malicious plans, it says here. And may my soul, Jacob says, not enter their council, nor my heart join their company. For in their rage they have killed men. Accursed be their rage for its ruthlessness, their wrath for its ferocity. So that sounds like a curse to me.
Doesn't Jacob say why Reuben didn't get...
Yeah, he does, but he's not... Like, if they assign a topic to Reuben, then we're going to really focus on that. Remember, it's Judah we have to zero in on. And we only have a few minutes. So let's look at Judah here. And now we come to Judah, and wow, your brothers will praise you. You grip your enemies by the neck. It's not like Judah was... you know, not warlike even, but apparently there was a just war back then even. Your father's sons will do you homage. Judah is a lion's whelp. You stand over your prey, my son, like a lion. He crouches down and goes on with this metaphor of the lion. And then there's several lines here that, depending on if you're reading the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation, or one of the different Hebrew fragments that, you know, I don't know how far back they go, then you read it several different ways. This one favors the Septuagint a little more, and so compare it with verse 10 with the King James. The scepter shall not pass from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until tribute be brought to him, and the peoples render him obedience. Now, the way that some of the other translations do this, they put a messianic twist on it. It becomes a very early prophecy of the deliverer, of the Messiah, of Jesus. And it shifts until Shiloh come, and the people's attention will be gathered to him. And those translations rest on, it's helpful to know that Middle Eastern languages don't write in vowels. They write in consonants, and vowels are understood. And what happens is sometimes you've got words that are exactly the same in their consonants, but the vowels are different, and they make very different words out of it. And usually you can tell which is which in context, not always. So this verse, this passage, here it says, and the meaning is much disputed. So those silly academics and theologians carry on about this. Meanwhile, it's time to close, and is there something really important that someone wants to say yet? If not, then I'll just simply close with simply saying that, you know, I'll answer my own question. You know, the Joseph story seems to be fatalistic in the way that it is represented. You've done evil things, and God has turned that around for good. I am going to suggest that that needs to be nuanced a little bit. And I'm going to point to Judah's role in that. And there's several places, pivotal places in the Joseph story where Judah's idea for justice, his concern for doing what was right, the overarching right, not the little bitty right and wrong, you know, tattle or not tattle, but do we kill our brother or not? Do I bring Benjamin back to my father or not? Those things mattered, and they made the story come out like it did. The Joseph story wouldn't have existed if Joseph had died. It may have been a story like that, but not Joseph's story. So that's the tempering comment that I have on that seemingly fatalistic understanding of that story. And I thank you for your attention and your patience in this difficult topic. And I am going to turn the meeting back to you, moderator.